For the week of July 27th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 244, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz.
What are you talking about? You know, you do know what month it is, right? Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania is where Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog, comes out of the ground, sees its shadow, goes back underground, and then we have six more weeks of winter.
That's true. But I somehow feel like I'm reliving my day all over again.
Okay, so what you're referring to is that we recorded the show yesterday.
Sort of. We started to.
But
lots of technical issues.
Yes. And I blame Time Warner Cable, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so we did a little bit of it. Now we're doing it all over again.
That's right. Because we want to make it perfect just for you, especially since we haven't really done a show in 2 weeks.
Yes. Where the heck have you been?
I was actually in New England, where apparently, by the way, Michael, you may not want to wear your Yankees hat up in Boston or north of Boston.
That's true. We keep beating them, and so they want to beat us back.
Yes, and we're not beating people, okay? We're talking about the New York Yankees beating the Boston Red Sox.
Both teams are weak, so that's not really the case right now. Bad season for both of us. So we've been gone for 2 weeks. Has anything happened?
Well, first of all, everyone died, okay? Even Archie of comic book fame. Apparently, he took a bullet for gay Kevin.
That's true.
Yeah. So wait until the end of the show, and we'll talk about all the people who died and how you can celebrate their lives and work. But, you know, Michael, you would think that we were on hiatus for like 5 years with all the stuff that happened. I mean, the trailer for 50 Shades of Grey, it got released and nearly took down the entire internet. The body of the recently deceased Casey Kasem, the DJ, it went missing, but apparently now is found somewhere in Montreal. Country music star Garth Brooks, he came out of self-imposed retirement and promptly gets thrown out of Ireland. He probably drank too much. Weird Al Yankovic's new album, I can't even believe I'm saying that, it's number one at the charts. At the charts? On the charts. Rosie O'Donnell is back on The View. She was once on The View before, then kind of left, and now she's back. Cats the Musical, it's back too. It's being remounted in London. Rocky the Musical is closing, which surprised, well, nobody, really. Everyone loves Netflix now, Michael, in case you weren't aware. Well, at least the 50 million subscribers all around the world that subscribe to the I guess, what would you call it, a streaming service?
Yep.
Yeah, okay, VOD service? I don't know. Everyone loves Netflix now. The Weinstein Company, they totally forgot to release their movies in cinemas before sending them to VOD and premiering them on Yahoo. Of all places, Yahoo. I mentioned Archie, the comic book character. He's now dead. Thor, the superhero? Now a woman. Wonder Woman, the superhero? Still a woman, but now we have pictures of her appearance in some of, I guess, some new movie that she's either starring in or it's all about her. We have Comic-Con to thanks for that. Aereo, remember them? Ye of the Supreme Court's You Look Like a Cable Company, So You Are a Cable Company decision. This was like 2-3 weeks ago. Now they've decided, okay, we're a cable company. Apparently, the copyright office said, yeah, no, you're not. The Emmys. Oh, the Emmys. The Television Academy completely forgot network television existed when they handed out this year's Emmy nominations. But don't worry, so did advertisers when purchasing campaigns for next year's season. All of this and more we'll talk about on this week's Showbiz Sandbox. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. Or it should be a short conversation, though, given the fact that, you know, every headline I read about this summer's box office is bemoaning the fact that there is no box office this summer.
So when you were in New England, did you take up drinking coffee?
I don't know what would ever give you that impression. Could it be all of the stories that I had to talk about in under 2 minutes right there? I have no idea what you're talking about. Although this beverage is delicious.
So box office is slumping. We're almost towards Labor Day, which is the end of the official summer season, and it looks like we'll be down about 15 to 20% compared to last year. Of course, last year was the best year of all time for summer box office, but it looks like we'll be at an 8-year low, which is never great, though I would argue, of course, that summer as a period doesn't mean as much anymore because spring is stronger than it used to be.
Well, that's true. I mean, let's face it, like 40% of the $10 billion domestic North American box office comes during the summer.
Used to.
And well, it's still,
you know,
kind of,
I mean,
did.
If you get more big hits in January, February, and March, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, but, you know, you had, what was it, Fast and Furious 7, that got pushed because of Paul Walker's death, so yeah. That was off the table. That was going to probably be released in April or May, actually. I don't know when it was going to be released, but it was a summer release. And you have Captain America was released in April, so that was taken out of summer.
The Lego movie was like in February or March.
Right, so it's good to have a February, or I think that was a February release, due $200 million. It's good to have a blockbuster release not only in May and June and July, but also, hey, what about March? Throw one in March. Make me go to the theater in March. Make it a habit.
Exactly. So as we've said, the summer has not had a huge hit in North America, but also hasn't had any big flops. And the worldwide box office has certainly made up for any weakness in the North American market for a lot of movies. That's why we talk about worldwide box office. We get our figures from RentTrack. We link to them in our show notes. We also pull info from Variety and Hollywood Reporter and the LA Times and everywhere else. And the number one movie around the world is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. For the very first time, they're at number one. They grossed $70 million worldwide. They're at $355 million and counting, and they dethroned Transformers, which had been number one for a few weeks in a row.
I like the fact that you're actually referring to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, the movie, as they, as if they're plural, as if they're, they exist, like the apes actually, you know, they like
took
they,
over the box office.
Yeah, like they beat the Yankees or something.
That's right. So Transformers fell down to number four. As we've said before, they're about to break $1 billion. Everyone else has woken up to this fact. And of course, why is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes number one? And why is Transformers crashing through $1 billion?
I would say, well, first off, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is a, what do they call it when your movie is actually good? What do they call that?
That's right. But as far as the total box office, World Cup. They've expanded to a lot of markets where they weren't playing before. Latin America, Europe, now Dawn and Transformers are playing in all those places.
Yeah, I guess the World Cup, especially in Europe, saw the box office decline quite drastically. But what's remarkable is that in places like Russia or England, where their teams were out in the first round, in the group round, they thought, well, box office will come back now that our teams are out. You know, people will get out of the house and go to the theater. That was not the case.
Well, the people love watching the World Cup. It's not just their own country. And they also, it's hard to switch your scheduling that quickly. One or two movies did open up quicker because of Russia falling out or England falling out. But in general, you know, you've got to lock in your plans months in advance. So Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is number one with $70 million. Transformers is about to crash through $1 billion and still going strong with $42 million. But at number two is Hercules, the Dwayne Johnson film, $57 million worldwide. I think it's the best-reviewed Hercules movie of all time.
It's the best-reviewed Hercules movie of all time. That's amazing. I mean, there's been so many well-reviewed Hercules movies.
Yeah, all of them have sucked. The trailer for this one sucked. It looked god-awful. And nobody's saying it's a great movie, but all the reviews have sort of said, hey, it's dumb, it's silly, but it knows what it is, and it's kind of fun.
You know, back in March, Dwayne Johnson, the star of Hercules, who plays Hercules, he showed up at CinemaCon, and his entrance, he came in through the back door at the Colosseum over at Caesar's Palace. It took him 10, 15 minutes to get up to the stage. I'm exaggerating, but only by a little. It took him a while to get up to the stage because everybody wanted to, you know, high-five him and give him a hug, and he's much beloved in the exhibition industry. He's done quite well for them. And he said, hey, you know, when I was doing this film, I was on social media taking the pictures on the Twitter and the Facebooks and the Instagrams, but I didn't want to show my face because I grew my hair out. I have a little beard.
He's got a Hercules look.
Yeah, I wanted that to be, you know, a surprise and be kind of new and fresh when we started to promote the movie this summer. So this will be the first time, and, you know, he's introducing clips of the first time you'll ever see, you know, my face as Hercules on the big screen. And I'm thinking, you know, actually, given what we just saw, people may not see you as Hercules ever.
Oh, because the trailer was so bad.
Exactly.
Well, and yet now it's turned out that, you know, the harmless fun is the take on Hercules. And it sounds like his intro at NATO was the same as what's it called?
CinemaCon, but it is CinemaCon. A NATO show. NATO, yeah. The National Association of Theater Owners.
Right. It sounds like Robert Downey Jr. Comic-Con, which just took place while we were away. He was throwing roses out to the crowd like a rock star when he took the stage for The Avengers 2. But anyway, at number three around the world is Lucy, the Luc Besson film starring Scarlett Johansson, who of course also stars as an action hero in Avengers and Winter Soldier, Captain America. But now she's got her own franchise, her own big movie, Lucy, a woman who's using 100% of her brain. Not just 6% like us mere mortals. Mortals? Mortals.
Well, you know, we here on Showbiz Sandbox, we use like 6.5%. most of them. Yeah,
let's not boast, but yeah, sure, I think that's true.
Okay.
At number four around the world, of course, is Transformers. And what's the big news about that film? It's crossing $1 billion, thanks in part, of course, to China, where it grossed $300 million so far, an all-time record for that country.
And of course, you know, since it earned so much in China, Paramount, which of course made and is releasing the film, it will take home, you know, 25 cents.
That's right. Out of $300 million, they will take home $75 million rather than the typical $150 million that they would make in most of the rest of the world. That's why I think the studio should stand up to China. This is the time. They're only going to get bigger and stronger. They need big movies. Do you really want to leave $75 million on the table and just hand it to them? Or do you want to say, hey, you need Avengers 2. You need Avatar 2. I think now's the time to like do a showdown. They need your big movies. They got thousands of screens. They want to fill them. And you've got the stuff that they want.
Well, you know, they're going at, and if you listen to Showbiz Sandbox, you know this because we've talked about it all the time. China's a country going from about 3,000 screens to, I wouldn't be surprised if one day they have 50,000 movie screens.
Why not? They got 1 billion people.
Yeah. And there are some towns that don't have a movie theater at all. I mean,
well, of course, there's just a couple hundred million people who are living at subsistence level, but they have a massive, large, growing middle class of a couple hundred million people. So, you know, there's a lot of room for growth.
And you have all those movie theaters. You know what you're going to need to put on them? You have all those store shelves. I mean, if you really look at a movie theater as a distribution channel, a way to sell the product, which in this case is movies. And I know people hate it when I refer to a movie as a product, but certainly a company is making it and they are selling it through movie theaters, DVD stores, or, you know, video stores. Well, not really video stores anymore, Walmart, and television. There are different distribution channels in which they sell that product. If you look at that, they're going to, you know, China with 50,000 screens, they're going to need product to put on those shelves.
That's right. And maybe most of the time they're saying, well, we'll make our own product. We'll make our own movies, because at number five around the world is The Continent. This is a Chinese film. I think it's a road trip comedy sort of thing. It's directed by Han Han. It grossed $33 million over the weekend. It's at $45 million and counting. Han Han is like a Chinese pop culture superstar. He is a blogger. He is a race car driver. He's sort of I can't remember whether he avoids politics or talks a lot about politics. I can't remember, but he's a major cultural figure in China. And now he's directed his first film and it's a hit.
So he's kind of the Chinese version of Tony Stark.
That's right. He really kind of is, especially with the race car driving. So they've got hit films coming out of everywhere in China. So maybe they think we don't need Hollywood movies. But guess what? You're always going to want the biggest films in the world. And all the people who have invested and are going to make money off those theaters and those distribution channels, all those powerful politicians, all those powerful families, they're going to get annoyed when China blocks big movies coming into their country if there is a showdown. And they're going to see themselves as losing money. And their kids of the powerful people. I mean, it's a monopoly, so you've got no one to fight with except the government. But the kids will say, hey, I want to see Avatar. I want to see the Avengers. Why are you not letting us see them? You're a loser, Dad.
Well, you know, I always said that China is kind of notorious for piracy and being able to go down to the corner and buy the latest releases, whether from Hollywood or elsewhere, for, you know, a dollar on some pirated DVD. And I said, when China will care about piracy and copyright protection and, you know, IP infringement when they actually have something, you know, some skin in the game. Well, with all these theaters, they stand to lose money if people are pirating content. So they're going to start caring about piracy specifically because of what you just said, Michael.
That's true. And I would also do it as sort of a shaming thing. You want to say you're a world power. You want to say you're ready to enter the world stage. Then why aren't you going to pony up like the big boys? You know, why can't you match what, you know, these tiny little countries are paying for our movies? You know, you want to say you're a big player, then step up to the plate and pay the big price. Well, at number six around the world is How to Train Your Dragon 2. That made $26 million. That's at $425 million worldwide. Probably a bit of a disappointment, given the good reviews for that film and the success of the first one in the series. At number seven around the world is a South Korean film, Kundo, Age of the Rampant. It made $20 million over the weekend. It is sort of a period Robin Hood film. It's about a gang of outlaws who steal from the rich and give to the poor, and it's a big hit in South Korea. At number eight around the world is Planes, Fire and Rescue. That's the latest in the Planes franchise from Disney Pixar. That made $16 million. It's at $56 million worldwide. And number nine is Purge the Anarchy. That's a sequel. Of course, it fell hard, like a lot of horror films do. It made $15 million, and it's now just about $60 million worldwide. And at number 10 is Sex Tape, the not-so-sexy comedy starring Cameron Diaz and Jason Segel. Another $12 million for that film. They're at $37 million and counting. And then at number 11, another Chinese film. This is The House That Never Dies. It's a horror film. It was shot in 3D. It made $8 million over the weekend, and it's at $50 million and counting, all in China alone. And this is a very, very successful film about horror that has really struck a nerve. The house that's talked about in the movie, people are going there as a tourist site. It's already just a big, big success story. So maybe China's saying, you know what, in about a week, we're not going to need your movies at all.
That's true. And you know what I would do to that house where it was shot? I'd turn it into a movie theater.
They probably will. And number 13, another Chinese film. I'm sorry, number 12, Tiny Times 3.0. It made $7 million. It's now at $73 million and counting. This film is the third in a series. The first two were based on a novel. The first film was based on half of the novel. The second film was based on the second half of the novel, just like they do in Hollywood these days. It's a story of like three or four or five girls who are friends in high school and remain friends throughout adulthood. It's also directed by an internet blogger turned film director, and it's proven very, very successful. So maybe they don't need us at all. And at number 14, way down there past Maleficent, is Godzilla. It finally opened in Japan. I don't know why Japan had to be the last country in the world to see Godzilla. You think they'd be the first country world, because that's where he comes from.
Well, they discovered Godzilla.
It's made $500 million. It's at $500 million. And again, given the cost of the movie and how much it took to market, that's got to be a bit of a disappointment. Would you be hungry and eager to make a sequel to Godzilla? I don't know.
No, at $500 million, no, because you know that it's only going to go down. The next one will make $400 million. So.
Well, that's not the case these days, is it, really?
No, you're right. You're right.
There's no given anymore. It used to be a truism that the sequel would make less than the original. And, of course, in a series where there's a one long story, sometimes the first film introduces the movie, and then the second one kicks it up into a higher gear. That's what happened with Twilight. That's what sort of happened with Mockingbird, what's called the Hunger Games. So, but this is just a standalone. It's not part of a series. It didn't get good reviews. There's no excitement about it. So I certainly wouldn't be rushing out to make a sequel.
Well, then where's that dragon tattoo lady? Shouldn't she be
exactly,
back by now?
Yeah, that's what they do. You don't always make the sequel just because you make the original.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, those are the big movies worldwide. Some movies made attention just for being on VOD. The Weinstein Company had two films that sort of created a little bit of controversy. Snowpiercer came out in theaters just a couple weeks ago. That's another South Korean film, but has English language stars like Jamie Bell and Tilda Swinton. It got very good reviews, and it's already out on video on demand. And similarly, One Chance. This is a biopic of the winner of Britain's Got Talent. His name is Paul Potts. He sings opera. It's not a very good movie. It didn't get very good reviews. It only made $6 million in the UK. Nobody in the U.S. really knows who Paul Potts is. And he had a brief flurry of attention, but his album certainly didn't do well like they did in the UK. So he's really an unknown quantity. And this movie has zero interest for the American audience, unless it was great and, you know, got a lot of great reviews. But this movie has just no buzz about it. So the Weinstein said, you know what? We're going to show it for free on Yahoo.
And that is remarkable. When are they doing this? Have I already missed it?
No, it's going to happen 10 days before it comes out in theaters. That's the plan. It's going to stream for 10 days on Yahoo before it opens up in the U.S. They've been messing with the premiere date, so I'm not exactly sure when it's going to happen. But the idea is show it on Yahoo for streaming for free. People look at it and say, oh, I watched it. It was fun. And then maybe that'll send somebody to the movie theater, because God knows if they open this up in 10 screens, it would make no money.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, look, I don't agree with the Snowpiercer thing. I think that the Snowpiercer, they said, oh, we were trying to keep it on the down low and keep it secret that it was going to be released on VOD. So
why would they keep it secret? Don't they want people to know?
Well, no, they didn't want the public to know that it was going to be on VOD so quickly.
But I thought the whole point was that you did VOD and DVD and all this stuff as soon as possible because you wanted to piggyback on all the attention you got for theatrical release.
Yes, but they didn't want to cannibalize their theatrical release by letting people know, look, just wait 2 weeks and you can watch it on iTunes.
Uh-huh.
So,
and it's still available on theaters, but it's made $2 million on video on demand in its first week. And they think it's going to set a record for the Weinstein Company. The most they've ever made on VOD is $8 million. And they think this movie will match and or exceed that.
Yeah. And I don't know how you keep something like this secret, you know, a follow on quick VOD release by shortening the window that quickly, because all the theater owners have to know about it. The theater owners knew that, hey, this is going to be a 2 week exclusive in theaters, in cinemas. And then 2 weeks after it hits theaters, it will be released on VOD without very much fanfare. It just kind of showed up on iTunes. And then, all these news stories started
right.
screening.
So it was a couple hundred screens around the country. It opened on a few, did pretty well. It's made a couple million dollars, about right. $2 million. Now it's still on 150 screens and it's available on video on demand. And theater owners are angry. They think it's a mistake. They say, look, there's a reason why we have all this, these windows, because you show in the theaters and that brings attention for VOD and DVD and Blu-ray and cable and pay-per-view and all that sort of stuff. They say, there's a reason why this ecosystem has developed over the years. A strong window serves both ends of the market. That's what NATO said in a statement when they heard about the Weinstein streaming One Chance on Yahoo for free before it even played in a movie theater.
I'm always a little reticent about hearing with these messing around with these windows. And I kind of think, well, you're going to cannibalize cinema. You're going to kind of destroy the cinema going experience, as Christopher Nolan wrote an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that talked about this. That said, if these distributors weren't trying something, we would kind of fault them for not being innovative.
Well, not the theater owners. They'd be perfectly happy keeping things the way they are.
The distributors, not the theater owners.
I'm talking
right, about the
theater owners would not be happy.
Right. And I'm saying that if the distributors weren't trying something and not being responsive to the marketplace and how people are watching and consuming content, then we would kind of fault them.
Observers.
Right.
Yeah. But not the theaters. They want things to stay the way they are because they're afraid of change. And they see, hey, if you find out you're going to make more money by releasing things on video on demand, I lose out. So they obviously are threatened for their business. But as far as we see, look, you got a movie that nobody knows about or cares about called One Chance. It stars a talented actor. It's got some good people in it, but it's got no buzz. What are you going to do? You want people to somehow know it's out there? Try something. It's not like they're taking, The Avengers 2 and showing it on Yahoo for 10 days before it opens in a theater. That would be kind of stupid. But One Chance, Snowpiercer, these are oddball films. You want to do stuff to try and get attention, see what works.
Well, and not everybody will know that it's streaming for free.
Oh, of course not.
On Yahoo during the first 10 days. You can't reach everybody. And, Michael, you and I were talking about this artist. She's a songwriter for Madonna and Beyonce and Rihanna. She's written a number of hit songs, including Titanium. Her name is Sia. She doesn't like her face to be seen or shown, so she does all these interviews with her back to the camera. And she had this video that was released for her own album that she's releasing, I guess, soon. I think sometime this fall. And the video is for Chandelier, which went on to have 82 or 83 million views on YouTube. The video was released at the beginning of May. I didn't see it until Sunday.
Videos are never exclusive you don't have to pay for them. What does this have to do with what we're talking about?
I guess what I'm saying is I didn't even know about this woman until Sunday. So there is a way to build some kind of buzz around something that you're giving away for free and then take back, in this case, a movie that you take back and say, oh, did you hear about that viral thing on the internet? Yeah, well, now you have to go to a theater to see it.
Right, so streaming for 10 days does not mean it's free forever and that everybody who could conceivably want to see the film will watch it streaming on Yahoo.
Yeah, the first thing I did when I saw this video and saw all the attention that it was getting and heard some of her songs, I went to see if Sia was playing in my neighborhood, if it was playing Los Angeles. I got very excited to find out that she's playing August 10th. I got very disappointed when I realized it was August 10th, 2011. But, that said, look. A free video caused me to seek out something that I would pay for.
Mm-hmm. So basically, it's just, you got to try stuff.
Yeah.
But theater owners say, guess what? The best proven thing to do to make the most money for your project when it's a decent project is to show it in a movie theater with a proper release and proper advertising. That's going to make it more valuable down the food chain.
Well, I think that's probably true, at least right now.
Right. And what we're looking at here is just, hey, these are just oddball, quirky little things, and you got to do something to break through the noise.
Yeah.
And Disney did the same thing. They broke through the noise with a huge, bold announcement. They made clear that, yes, Disney will be making and releasing films even 5 years from now. Disney is not going to stop making movies.
Okay. And I'm sure that there's something else to that.
Not
to
really.
That news.
They've announced, hey, we're going to release some movie in May of 2019. We're going to release a movie in July of 2018. We won't tell you what they are. We won't tell you what they're about. But by God, we will be releasing movies years in the future.
So really what we're talking about is release date bingo, or this release date shuffle, where
it's so ridiculous.
Where, you know, all of these companies are, they're producing these huge movies, $300 million to produce and market these movies, that they're staking a claim on certain dates so that when Spider-Man 900 or whatever they're up to now decides to get pushed back, I guess, what was it, pushed back from one date in 2016 to 2018. I don't know when it was pushed back, but basically Marvel came in immediately and jumped on it.
Right. So they all want to claim space for themselves. And sometimes when it's a big movie, you want to give it a 2 week berth. I mean, you don't want to release another movie the week before or the week after, and certainly not the week of, unless you're counter programming, blah, 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 like The Fault in Our Stars. So they're all sort of claiming dates months and they're getting more. They're going to send, you know, in a minute, they're going to say, I've got May of 2025. Nobody do that. You know, Star Wars 20 will be out in May of 2025. Everybody stay away.
Well, to give you some kind of perspective on Spider-Man, I don't know whether it's the release date change that was interesting or that it was Marvel and Spider-Man. The story about Marvel snaps up old Spider-Man 4 date, likely for Avengers 3. That was shared 48 and saved 48,000 times on Feedly, the RSS reader I use. And that's just one RSS reader. Mm-hmm. And that's remarkable for that kind of
And should anybody care what happens on a release date 3 or 4 years from now? I mean, you know, really? I mean, unless you're a studio exec, why would you care?
Yeah, I mean, this is basically just throwing markers on the calendar to try and kind of steer other studios away.
And the place where they do that a lot is Comic-Con, which took place while we were gone. That's where you get a lot of these announcements. One of the big announcements, of course, was that Guardians of the Galaxy, which hasn't opened yet, it has a sequel and a release date.
This movie looks so iffy. I mean,
oh, I don't know. The reviews from Variety and Hollywood Reporter were both positive. They both said it was goofy fun. One was slightly more positive than the other, but they both said it was a good time.
Okay,
I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Really? Okay, because the footage that I've seen, I've raised at least one eyebrow going, really, guys? I don't know about this. But maybe they've pulled it off.
Yeah, so the announcements at Comic-Con are the big news. Bringing out a big star and announcements. Comic-Con is so big, it's almost boring now. Not to attend. I think it's still fun, but it still feels so industry-driven, feels so much a platform just to make big announcements, that sense of a fan-driven event is a little bit lost, I think. But I think it's still fun to go, I'm sure. It's fun to see people dressed up in costumes. They're all pretty clever and good. You can even perhaps look at a comic book, but it just feels like an excuse to announce release dates for me from looking at it from the outside. So I don't know. The bloom's a little bit off the rose, but there was some noise. George R.R. Martin was there, and he made clear he's not going to write a script for the next season of Game of Thrones. He's not even going to visit the set because he's actually going to finish the book.
Yeah. You want to take bets on this? Is there
no, he's going to finish the book. He's got book 6. It's going to get done.
Okay.
Don't tell him it's not going to get done or he'll curse at you.
Okay. Well, I'll believe it when I see it.
Quentin Tarantino announced he will be making The Hateful Eight. That is the Western. He had a script for that. It leaked online. He was suing Gawker. We've talked about it before. It sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds like an inexpensive movie. It's mostly in one set. And he said, no, that's going to be my next movie. I'm going to make it. He just has to, you know, make it happen. So that's cool.
Well, you know, I guess then with all these release date announcements, you're probably not very excited about Pirates of the Caribbean 5 being released July 7th, 2017. You probably could care less about that.
Well, it's pointless. They don't have a script. They don't have whatever. I mean, do they have a director? They probably do. Yeah, they
yes,
do.
They do. Got,
yeah, but whatever. Who cares? Yeah, no, I don't care about release dates 4 years in the future.
Yeah, you know, I asked Jeff Boucher, formerly of the Los Angeles Times and Entertainment Weekly, to join us to talk about
At the last minute.
And he got back and said, yeah, sure. But I thought, you know, why have Jeff Boucher on to talk about Comic-Con when we could have him on to talk about, you know, we want unfiltered Jeff Boucher. We don't want him to have to talk about Comic-Con, you know, which, by the way, of course, he's always... he's there and he's always moderating some panel or two or three or nine panels.
He's a big kahuna.
Yes. But so let's have him talk about his new podcast or something, not Comic-Con.
All right. So he's going to be on in a week or two?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to get back to him and see if we can get him on to talk about, well, anything. I mean, you know, talking to Jeff Boucher is always a lot of fun.
All right. He won't be talking about the Emmys, though. That happens on August 25th. That's not really his thing, but they are happening. They're coming up soon. And we, of course, missed the nominations announcement, but it's now just a few weeks away before the Emmys actually happen. You know, as always, there were snubs. There were shows that had big years like Fargo and other shows that didn't get much of anything like The Americans and The Good Wife and The Walking Dead. But overall, Sperling, what are the big trends from the Emmys that we spotted now that we've had a chance to absorb all the nominations and all the categories?
Well, you know, I think Jeff Boucher, you said he's not going to be talking about the Emmys because that's not his thing. You know, I think some other folks who aren't going to be talking about them are people who work for any network, you know, broadcast network, basically.
Right, because ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, they're really just sitting in the stands watching what happens.
Yeah, I mean, if you consider PBS a broadcast network, then maybe, you know, Downton Abbey gets nominated for Best Drama Series. But otherwise, you have to be a cable network to get an Emmy nomination, or Netflix.
Not a cable network, you just have to make a good show.
Okay, well, it seems like
But people say, you know, The Good Wife got slammed. It should have gotten a nomination this year. They felt like it came back strong. And that was the one network show. That's it. That's the only network show anybody said, hey, they got dissed. There's not a single, you know, maybe The Blacklist should have been nominated, but not really. Nobody really thinks that. They think maybe James Spader should have gotten nominated for Best Actor because that's a big, chewy, showy performance. And that show has helped revive NBC. But nobody's outraged about what network shows didn't make the cut.
I think maybe the James Spader thing is that every other Emmy voter thought, well, somebody will nominate him. I'll throw my nomination behind X person, but, you know, somebody else will probably nominate James Spader.
That's right. That happens. So, you know, this year, as always, it looks like they'll sort of nominate and reward the same shows again and again. Breaking Bad feels like old news in a way. I mean, if you're just talking quality, obviously that deserves to win for best drama. It probably will because the Emmys never shy away from being tired and obvious. But, you know, if you're talking about is it the best show of the year, absolutely. But also, since it ended like a year ago, just when the last Emmys happened, it felt like we already celebrated the show. So if you wanted to be timely, it might be something like Game of Thrones or True Detective, but most likely it'll be Breaking Bad will win best drama. I think Fargo will win best miniseries, and I think it's unquestionable. You can lay all the money you want on this that The Normal Heart will win best TV movie. You can't even place a bet because the odds are no good. The only question is what will win best comedy?
Well, okay, so here is where we actually have one or two network shows. You have The Big Bang Theory and Modern Family, but then it's up against Louie, which is on, I think, FX. Orange is the New Black, which is on, wait, what network is that on again? Oh, yeah, no network. It's on Netflix. Silicon Valley is an HBO show, and Veep is an HBO show. Veep, I thought was, you know, I've seen a couple episodes. It's kind of funny.
Well, its second season was really strong. A number of actors got nominated for supporting roles this time around, so it might be the season for Veep, and certainly they love Julie Louise Dreyfus. I think everyone thinks Modern Family is old and tired. It doesn't deserve to win yet again, but that's exactly the sort of thing the Emmys like to do. On the other hand, maybe Big Bang Theory. It's the number one show in the country. It's the most popular show. It's never won Best Comedy. I wouldn't vote for it, but maybe this is the year where it slips through and does it. But, you know, that's probably between those three.
Now, has Jon Hamm ever won an Emmy for Mad Men?
Nope.
Yeah, because this would be the year, I guess, to give it to him. But let's face it.
No, it wouldn't be because it wasn't a good year for the show. It didn't even deserve to be nominated for Best Drama. The year where he might win is the year when the show says goodbye.
That's next year, I suppose.
Yeah,
right?
It's not this year. Right. So there's a lot of nominations out there. There is a quirky little thing, though, that got explained a little bit more. One of our contributors, Aaron Rich, pointed it out to me, a story about the credits on a show. When we talk about, is this a miniseries? Is this a TV movie? Is this a drama? You know, part of it, is it a comedy? Part of it is, you know, the network trying to figure out what's the category where they can win the most Emmys. And another part of it is credit sequences. You know, if you get a credit that says your show is created by, if there is a title card that says created by Michael Giltz, then you cannot qualify for being a miniseries or movie. You're disqualified. It won't happen. So, you know, if in your negotiations you get a created by credit on the show, that means it won't be a miniseries. No chance. Can happen. Never going to happen. Unless, of course, you ask for an exemption.
Okay.
So this means Fargo avoided that credit by that credit. They say their show is created for television by.
Okay.
And that's instead of created by. And that means they could be nominated in the best miniseries category. Other shows like American Horror Story say created by, but they ask for an exemption so they can be in the miniseries category. And then some shows like True Detective decide, hey, we want to be in the drama category. So, you know, there are all these rules and things. You got to have 6 episodes or you can't be a miniseries or a series. Then you're just a TV movie. You know, that's why Sherlock is always in the TV movie category. So there are all these little quirky rules that determine where a show goes in. But basically, you can finagle them any way you need to or ask for an exemption and get into any darn category you want. And that, frankly, should end. It should be determined by the Emmys, not by the network.
Well, I wonder if forcing them to look, if you pick miniseries now, you will forever be in the miniseries category. So don't be
like
picking
Downton Abbey. But which yeah, first, like, yeah, like, oh, we're not a series. We don't know if we're coming back. Of course we're coming back.
Yes. We don't know if we're coming back. Season 2 airs on. Yeah. It's I agree with you, but I wonder if you had told them, look, you can go with miniseries right now, Downton Abbey, and you'll win because everybody loves you and you won't have as much competition as you would in the, you know, outstanding drama category, but realize that you will forever be in that miniseries category. You'll never be able to jump over to outstanding drama series.
But that's unsatisfying if you think it shouldn't be in the miniseries category in the first place.
Yeah, true.
Right. If they choose the wrong category and you feel like, no, that's a drama. It's not a comedy. No, it's a TV movie. It's not a, you know, then it's annoying every year. The one suggestion I also like came from Tim Goodman at The Hollywood Reporter. He says, look, you got to expand the categories more. They've already done that. You've got 6 dramas up for best drama. You've got 6 shows up for best comedy. But in the acting category, same thing. You got 6 slots for actors, but there's so many channels. So many TV shows. He says, but maybe there should be 8. Maybe there should be 10. Maybe it should be a sliding scale. You know, why limit yourself when you've got so many shows to choose from?
I think what they really need to do is what the Academy did, the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts and Sciences did with Best Picture, where it could be 5 nominees for Best Picture or 10, depending on some really rubric kind of mathematical equation.
You know, if you get above 10%, then you're nominated for Best Drama, you know. If 10% of the people, you know, you don't just give it to 100 shows. You don't want to make it so many that it becomes pointless. But, you know, you just limit it to 10 at the most. But they each have to get at least 10% of the vote. You know, then there you go.
I just wanted to try and explain that math algorithm again to, you know, our audience.
Well, I'm making up a formula, but it's something like that. You know, 10% would mean that you'd have at most 10 shows. If one gets 30% of the vote, if everybody voted for Breaking Bad, 30% of people, that only leaves 70%, and so you'd only have at most 8 shows.
Well, you're trying to make up an algorithm, and I was trying to make up a joke based on this huge, confusing algorithm that the Academy does for Best Picture, which I guess you'd have to know about for it to be funny at all.
I'm sorry, you were making a joke?
Exactly. There you go. Trying, I think, was the proper definition of what I was trying to do. In fact, you know, trying is what the TV networks are trying to do when they hold their upfronts. They're trying to sell their ad space for next season, and apparently they're down by about $600 million.
Ouch! That's a lot of money.
Yes.
Now, is that being made up by cable? Is cable taking up
the
money?
No. Actually, both cable and broadcast networks are down about... the broadcast networks are down about $600 million less. But the cable networks are also down. You have 2 major television advertisers, General Motors, Procter & Gamble. They lowered their ad buys during the upfront, so that's going to hurt. But let's face it, I mean, we're talking about $18 billion, $19 billion. It's not like we're saying, oh man, how are you ever going to survive? We're talking about it's down $600 million in a multi-billion dollar market.
But just like the summer box office is down like $300 million, one big hit would have cleared up the deficit.
Right.
Right. So they're down. Why are they down?
Well, I think that a couple of reasons. Of course, the fragmentation of viewership does not help. And I think advertisers
you pay less for everything rather than a lot more for a few things.
Correct. I think that everybody's looking for what is going to be watched. So there will be spot buys during the year.
When they see what shows break out. And I've been watching fall pilots, and so far I don't see nothing.
Okay, so you've been watching them.
I don't see any big hits yet.
Okay. Well, that said, I also think that advertisers are beginning to spread their money around to, you know, interactive and web and other areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and networks are fighting back. They're saying, hey, look, we need to make sure advertisers know the audience we are reaching. And FX did an interesting thing. They had a new series called The Strain. It's sort of a horror flick. It's this TV series based on the novel by Guillermo del Toro. I think he co-wrote it. And it debuted, and FX, the next day, said nothing.
Well, you know why? You know why? Because that poster freaked me out and freaked everybody out.
It's a gross poster. Yeah, if you're in a big city and you see that poster on the side of a bus, you're like, ew!
There's like a worm coming out of an eyeball, and it really, I'm like, wow, I'm not going to watch that. That scares me.
Normally, the next day, they would trumpet the overnights, how well the show did in the overnights. FX said nothing. They waited for the live plus three ratings, and they waited like, I think it debuted on a Monday, and instead of announcing it on Tuesday, they waited till Friday. I'm making up the date, so it's something like that. And on Friday, they said, here are the ratings for the show. These are the live plus three ratings. These are what advertisers pay for. This is a bigger number than it would have been if we'd said the overnights. Why trumpet 2 million people in the overnights if you can wait 3 days and say, hey, 4.2 million people watched our show? It's a much bigger number. That's the number we want people to pay attention to. That's the number the show actually reached. That's the number advertisers pay for. So they sort of planted a flag and said, look, there's no reason to talk about, you know, a quick spot check of the overnights. Yes, it gives you a hint of where it's going to end up. But since those numbers can grow a lot, 50%, 100%, why talk about it? Why not wait till you have the actual figures about the number of people that watch the show? It's a good argument, I think.
Yes, and I agree with the argument because I believe that the first thing you say is usually what's remembered, even though it might not be accurate.
Exactly, exactly. So why rush out next morning to yell, hey, not as many people watch our show as we would like to say.
Yes, which is why we never publish our own numbers.
That's right. We never make a mistake on numbers. Ever.
Ever, no.
Unless we're talking about streaming.
Well, it depends on what kind of streaming, because if we're talking about streaming movies or cinema numbers, we never make a mistake, ever.
Perhaps on music.
Oh.
Yeah.
I knew you'd bring that up.
3 weeks ago, we got a little housekeeping. 3 weeks ago, we did a story at where music sales and such were at, and we referenced a factoid that claimed that 70 billion songs are available for streaming on various services. Whoops.
Yeah, well, okay, wait a second. We were quoting a story, I will say.
Did you misquote the story, or did the story have it wrong?
I think the story must have had it wrong. Well, tell me what we got wrong.
Well, I don't know. Well, in fact, the actual stats said that songs had been streamed 70 billion times. So, of course, that's just adding up. It doesn't tell you how many songs there are. It tells you how many times in total those songs have been watched or listened to. So, of course, one song alone might be streamed 10 million times. And in fact, there's songs that have been streamed 100 million times, which is exactly what Turned Down for What, for example, by DJ Snake and Lil Jon has done. So that's one song, and it counts for 100 million streams. So that's how it shows how popular the songs are, just the way you can add up how many times a YouTube video has been watched. Like you said, that video by Sia, how many times has that been watched?
I think 84 million times now.
Right. So that counts for 84 million of however many total viewings there are. It doesn't mean there are 84 million songs or videos out there. It means that one video was watched 84 million times. So that 70 billion songs have been streamed is not a reference to the total number of songs, but a reference to how many times in total they have been played.
Okay.
So that's a very different figure. And it made no sense. I think at the time we said, well, wait a second, there aren't 70 billion songs in existence.
Right.
There haven't been 70 billion songs recorded, though we're getting there soon enough. But think about that. 70 billion streams. If there was one penny paid for each stream, just one penny, that would be $700 million that you could share around among songwriters and musicians and studio musicians and producers and stars and record labels. That's a lot of money. But
yeah,
of course,
yeah, it's
they don't
like
get
actually
one penny per song.
Yeah, it's a fraction of one penny. But you know,
like 0.1 penny, 0.01 penny, 0.1/100th of a penny.
Yeah, I don't know. It depends, I think, on the license.
So people are watching a lot of songs. They're listening. See, I keep saying watching because I keep thinking of YouTube. They're listening and watching to a lot of music. They're just not paying a lot of money for it.
Hold on, I'm just making a note here. Learn how to read properly. Okay. I'm sorry, I just well, needed maybe, to add maybe, something to my to-do list.
Maybe they made the mistake. I don't know.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure that I, you know, learn how to actually read the news stories that we're covering properly. But since we're talking about reading, hey, what's going on in the publishing industry?
Quite a bit. Two big stories, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, one is a big story that we've been talking about for quite a while, which we all knew that Amazon would eventually, inevitably, try to launch some kind of Netflix for books. And they did.
They did. So they're joining the sweepstakes, the lottery, the attempt to break the code and get people to pay a monthly subscription fee to access a pile of books.
By the way, we call that the library, FYI. you can go to the library and do the same thing.
You can. Libraries are great. But of course, if it's a new release, it's a big popular book, they may buy 100 copies, but you're still going to have to wait a couple weeks or months in order to get your own copy and look at it at home.
Well, so, that's kind of like this new service from Amazon and Oyster.
No, you don't wait in line.
If it's available, it's
available. The point is that the library, you might have to wait 4 or 6 months. When my mom sees a new Maeve Binchy book has come out and she goes to the library rather than buying it, there's going to be a waiting list. She's going to have to wait weeks or months before she gets to check out her copy.
Well,
it doesn't mean libraries are great. They got a billion other books for you to check out. But that's just why they think there's a market for this beyond what's available at your local library.
Well, that said, I think that on Amazon and some of these other services like Oyster and Scribd, they don't have the books right away either. They have to wait. So new releases aren't showing up right away.
Well, that's just because they don't have the deals. Just like music, when you go to Pandora or whatever, most new albums are available right away, aren't they?
I think, yes. Well, certainly
on
Spotify.
So the idea is that the new books would be available too. That's the idea of the service. Not that you have to wait 6 months for the new Tom Clancy or whatever. The idea is that they would be available. Right now, though, they don't. They don't have any of the big publishers. Amazon launched this service. It's competing with Oyster and Scribd. And they have 600,000 titles available. Most of them, however, are self-published books or very small press titles. There are some big books and series like Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings and The Wimpy Kids. Those are for various loophole reasons, deals that they made with Pottermore, the J.K. Rowling website, or individual people. But basically, no big publishers are on board for this. They're scared about it. They don't know what to do. You can see a few publishers handing a few books over to Oyster and Scribd, but basically, they're stepping back and saying, I don't know about this. It didn't work great for music, and we're not sure it's going to work great for us.
Well, now you can see why Amazon and Hachette have been really going to war over their contract terms. It probably had nothing to do with the sale price of books.
It was not about getting them to say you have to make your books available to Kindle Unlimited.
No. I think it has to do with the cost of licensing. Ebooks and possibly even for...
Licensing. It has to do with how much you get paid per book.
Right.
Right. Yeah, but it had nothing to do with this.
But I guess what I'm saying is the digital issue was bigger than the physical issue.
You mean no, they wanted more for books, period, I think. They wanted bigger margins, not just for ebooks. They wanted bigger margins in general.
Okay. Well, it's still not solved.
It's true that Hachette gets a better margin on ebooks, but it doesn't mean they want to say, oh, well, we don't want more money for print. I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
But anyway, they wanted more money for the books they were selling. That was the debate. That is the debate between Amazon and Hachette. But they've got Kindle Unlimited. They want to charge $10 a month. It's not part of Amazon Prime. And basically, if you're a big author, even a big self-published author like Hugh Howey, what happens is if someone reads 10% of your book, Amazon pays you as if the person bought the book. This is what they did to launch their Amazon lending library a little while ago. They said basically, okay, if somebody lends a book out to someone else, we're going to pay the publisher as if it was purchased.
Oh, wow.
And that does not sound tenable, does it? That doesn't sound like a plan for a business unless you have 8 million people subscribing and only 4 of them actually reading the books. You know, it doesn't work if they actually consume the books. But that's how they're doing it. That's how they're doing it for the big names. For the littler people, the self-published people who don't have power, they basically say, all right, if someone reads 10% of your book, you get credited for having that person read your book, and there's going to be a pile of money every month, and we're going to split it up. We'll decide how, but you'll get some money.
Well, the untenable nature of that business model, as you say, Michael, may be why on Friday Amazon stock dropped 10%. So,
well, I don't think it was necessarily a reaction to that in particular, but they did say we're selling a lot of stuff. Our sales have jumped 25% to $19 billion in the second quarter. we also should mention that we're also losing a lot more.
Yes.
So sales have gone up and so have losses, which is exactly what happened to Barnes & Noble when they were trying to compete with Amazon, because every ebook they sold lost them money. Now Amazon is finding out the more they sell, the more money they're losing. A year ago in the second quarter, they lost $7 million.
Yeah,
this year they lost $126 million. And next quarter, they think their losses are going to jump from $25 million a year ago to like $800 million.
Wow. Okay. Somebody there ain't doing their job. You have to work really hard to earn $20 billion in revenue and still lose money.
That's not an easy thing to do.
Right, exactly.
That is tricky. And they, of course, always say, hey, look, we're not focused on quarter-to-quarter monthly profits. We're looking at the long term. They've been around for 20 years.
Well, not 20, but
yeah, 94.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right.
20 years they've been here. At some point, is it going to be their 100th anniversary when they show a profit? You know, at some point. And you don't, certainly, even if you're not making money, you want to show that you're getting closer. Not yes. farther away. Now, Amazon, as we know, they are very profitable in certain categories. They make a lot of money in digital storage, in backroom services to other companies. Don't think they haven't created some profitable businesses. They have. But they say we're always investing in new businesses, new markets, expanding our territory, squashing the competition. And that's why we're not showing an overall profit. But like, this is profitable, that's profitable, the other thing's profitable. Fair enough. And that kept people happy for 20 years.
But you know what? In France, they said, Go back to that part where you say squashing the competition, because that's why we're going to impose some laws here.
That's right. France, of course, we reported, said, look, you can't offer free shipping. If you're going to offer a sale price and you're limited to what sale price you can offer in France, you can only offer like 10% or 20% off. I forget what it is. But if you offer something on sale, you cannot also offer free shipping. It was basically an Amazon law to keep them from squashing the competition. Local bookstores couldn't offer free shipping. So Amazon would match them on price and then offer free shipping. And everyone said, mon Dieu, that's not acceptable. And they passed this law.
What did they say again?
They said, mon Dieu. So Amazon said, fine, we will charge for shipping. One penny.
Okay.
So now they've charged shipping of a penny or whatever it would be in France, whatever the smallest amount is. And people aren't happy about that, but we'll see where that ends up.
By the way, a note to legislatures in France, the politicians in France, you got to stipulate how much to charge, okay? A minimum, okay?
They wouldn't mind doing that. They like to have specific rules. So that's Amazon's fight in France. They're also fighting big publishers here in North America. Why? Because HarperCollins, for example, has just revamped their website, and they're now going to focus on selling books directly to consumers.
I don't know if that's tenable, frankly.
Well, they've done it all. They've done it for many years. They've often had books available on their website, but basically they haven't tried to sell books because they don't want to undercut the bookstores. Those are their partners. Those are the people that sell the books, and they don't want to undercut them. So you could always buy a book for many years at a publisher's website, but it was like at full price with, you know, shipping. So it wasn't really competitive. But now they said, we're getting worried that like the bookstores are going to disappear. Why are we letting everybody else? What if we sold direct? Think of all the money we'd make. So they have really revamped their website, and they're starting to get competitive. They've got books for 20% off and free shipping if you spend $50. That's getting pretty close to Amazon. If you look at some of the titles, I could see like on Amazon, they were $19, and at HarperCollins, they were $22, including, you know, shipping. So, you know, that's getting a lot closer. It's not the same, but it's certainly competitive as opposed to what it would be in the old days, which was just like list price plus a big shipping cost.
Well, you know, a couple of points here. One, when you have hundreds of publishers, it becomes an unviable solution because you can't find the books.
Right. Nobody says, I got to buy a new Simon & Schuster book.
Right. Okay. So there's no brand behind HarperCollins or maybe Farrar, Straus & Giroux or Knopf, there's a brand behind. But, you know, when you have all these publishers, it becomes unviable. However, all of these publishers have kind of consolidated over the last couple of years, over the last decade.
Well, there's the big five. There's Penguin Random House, which is also looking to revamp their website and do more of the same. There's HarperCollins, Hachette, Macmillan, and Simon & Schuster. When you're talking about the bestsellers, that's like 90% of them, 95% of them right there.
Okay, that said, you also never really want to muck up your sales channels. You don't want to piss off your sales channels because...
Well, that's why they never did it.
Well, right. But that said, in the publishing industry, there are no more sales channels. You have Amazon and you have Barnes & Noble, at least here in the United States. And in other countries, you have some physical bookstores, but they're very few and far between. And so without those sales channels...
Well, there are thousands of independent bookstores.
True.
you know, they're out there, but they're struggling and fighting. And I guess HarperCollins and the others are worried they won't be around in years to come.
Yes.
So, yeah, it is a hard thing. How do you get people to your website? They don't say, I want a new HarperCollins book. But, you know, more and more, they're also designed their website to make it easier for authors to sell it through them. So author websites, you create the author website, you create the link so it's easier for people to buy it through the author, through the publisher, rather than sending them to Amazon. You send them to the HarperCollins website or give them a widget so they can sell on their own website. People don't know HarperCollins, and he's not an author for them, but they do know Stephen King. They do know John Grisham. They do know J.K. Rowling. So if you're a fan of them and you go to their site to buy their book, and they're a HarperCollins author, they make it easier for them to do those sales and keep all the money in-house rather than just sending them to, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So that's really the end game, I think.
So, I mean,
you got a branded author and people buy the books through them, and the publisher is now going to make it a lot easier to do that.
I mean, so is it important or not important? I mean...
Oh, it's a big deal.
Oh, okay. So then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop. Our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Now, I know we've been going quite a while. We have like 2 weeks worth of news to catch up on. So bear with us. Our first story. You can talk about declining sales and a new normal all you want, but the number one show on TV is still the number one show on TV. The number one book on the New York Times bestseller list is still the number one book. And the number one album on the Billboard charts is still the number one album. And for the first time ever, the number one album in the country, and I never thought I'd be saying these words, is by Weird Al Yankovic. Sure, it only sold 104,000 copies, but in this day and age, that's actually good enough for number one. Heck, forget opening week. Mariah Carey has barely sold 100,000 copies of her new album in total. Plus, YouTube has been heaven for Weird Al Yankovic, whose song parody videos are ideal for online viewing. His new record is the first comedy album in some 50 years to top the charts. The last time it happened was when Alan Sherman's LP, My Son the Nut, hit number one back in 1963. Now I sound like Casey Kasem. Big Deal or Big Whoop, Michael?
Hello, mother. Hello, fada. That was the song off the Alan Sherman LP. We all loved it. He was there at Camp Granada or whatever the heck it was.
Yeah, that was the name of it.
It's a big deal. You know, he did a good campaign. He had big comedy stars in his videos. The videos helped sell the album, and 100,000 is a real number these days. So I think it is a big deal. It shows that with the right campaign and the right artist, you can still move some copies. It's not a million copies, but it's something.
Well, you know, what he did was for every song, he had a video, and he released them one per day. I think there were like 8 or 9 videos. I don't know how many videos there were in toto, as they say. However, what I would say is that everybody covered this. Every media outlet covered these videos at least once. So there was, you know, some talk in the Wall Street Journal of one of the videos since it related to corporate speak. And, you know, Rolling Stone mentioned them and all these outlets talked about them.
Yeah, when you get attention, that lets people know your album's coming out.
Well, somebody who's good at getting attention is Rosie O'Donnell. Goodbye, Barbara Walters. Hello, Rosie O'Donnell. The View has decided controversy is their friend and is bringing back Rosie O'Donnell. Her one-year tenure on the show was highly rated, but also high drama with Rosie butting heads with some of her on-air partners and the, you know, behind-the-scenes producer. Now, with mellow Whoopi Goldberg in charge displaying a similar caustic liberal vibe, it's likely Rosie will fit in smoothly and everyone will be much happier this time around. Now, why not bring back Joy Behar? That's my question. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
Oh, it's a big whoop. It's just, you know, bringing someone back to a show. Actor gets job, I guess, as our old friend Karen Woodward would say. But, you know, it's a smart move. And I think why not bring back Joy Behar? You've got almost everybody leaving the show. Why not give them that sense of familiarity that they want by bringing back some of the big names? I think it'll work out well.
You know, I think we should start a drinking game on this show where you take a drink every time Karen Woodward's name is mentioned, just for fun. And then we'll, like, okay, you know, bury a couple Karen Woodwards in each show. Karen Woodward, of course, being one of our former co-hosts.
Right.
Yeah. Now, Michael, I know you've been waiting for a revival of the musical.
Midnight, not a sound from the pavement. I'm sorry, what were you saying?
See, you were waiting for a revival of Cats. Well, I know you loved it. I know you'll see it again and again, but wait no more. The show has never gone away, of course, thanks to touring shows and regional and local productions. But a successful UK tour has prompted a new version to come to London for the holidays. It will play the Palladium for 12 weeks only. No matter how wildly popular it proves, this will be strictly limited. Seriously, you better go see it right now, again and again. The original creative team is on board, so it won't be radically rethought. However, Andrew Lloyd Webber did say he thought Rum Tum Tugger would become a street cat, and his song would be Wrapped, and one or two other tunes would be, you know, kind of tweaked with, overhauled. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, but the idea of a rap in Cats is just god awful. You know, Andrew Lloyd Webber, he's like, no, it works really well. You're like, oh my God, don't try to rap.
Yeah. This is, you know, T.S. Eliot, my friends. He turned T.S. Eliot poems into, music. T.S. Eliot did not rap.
The women come and go, speaking of Michelangelo, you know, but so yeah, I'm, you know, Cats is not, you know, it still tours North America too, but I've never seen it. I think it's well overdue for a Broadway revival, but I wish this had been a rethought production. I thought they'd wish they'd sort of really sort of come up with a fresh new way of doing it, because I think that's what'll really work to see if the show can play again for audiences. But I'm intrigued. I've never seen it.
You've never seen Cats?
No, never saw it. I almost saw it in London, but that's a long story.
Okay, well, you know, people for years would compare, like, every experience to Cats. It was better than Cats.
Well, that was the joke, yeah.
Yeah. Well, in a triumph for fair use, the documentary film L.A. Plays Itself, great documentary, by the way, is getting a digital release on major platforms September 30th. The film looks at the role of Los Angeles as a setting for and backdrop to movies. It's been screened for years in L.A., but with literally wall-to-wall clips that were not licensed. It was thought impossible to ever see the light of day in a commercial release. Never mind that all those film clips were fair use and didn't need to be licensed. Forget about that for a second. Never mind that lawyers had cleared the film a decade ago. Forget about that. Because of a restrictive attitude towards fair use, the film's creator felt he couldn't really risk an expensive lawsuit. Who can? That's now changed, and an article in the LA Times explains how it finally is getting a proper release, though not as yet on Blu-ray or DVD. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I think it's a nice breakthrough. It's probably just limited to this one film, but it's nice to have people wake up and say, no, you got to assert your fair use rights before you can claim them. You know, if you just give in and say, oh, no, I don't have the right to do this, even though you do, you're never going to get it. So it's good to see that they're doing it. Copyright was designed to encourage new works, not discourage them. It's been turned on its head with the way it's being used in the world today. So I'm really happy. This, too, was a story that was sent to me by Aaron, well, one of our friends who's been on the show before. He's moved to L.A. He's now studying film. And actually, he called me a few minutes ago, and I said, oh, I'm taping the show. I texted him back. He said, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. I'm only using 6% of my brain.
Oh, okay. Hey, call back.
Exactly.
Speaking of callbacks, with one-time superstars like Mariah Carey barely selling 100,000 copies of her new album and J-Lo barely cracking 50,000, what music needs is a real superstar, you know, other than Weird Al Yankovic. Cue country legend Garth Brooks. He took time off for 8 years to raise his family when Brooks was literally the biggest star in music, regularly selling 10 million plus copies of every album in the U.S. alone and filling up arenas. Now his kids are older, and after a stint in Las Vegas for 5 years that let him still remain a homebody of sorts, Brooks is ready to go whole hog. Get it? Whole hog? Because hogs.
Ah, I get it.
Yeah, and pig, you know, pigs, they're on farms.
Keep going,
and, okay.
Keep going.
He's got a new album ready to go and will tour the world. But will people still care? Apparently they care in Ireland. Big deal or big whoop?
It is a big deal. There's no bigger superstar that can come off the bench. I mean, for a while there, after his career or during it, he wanted to become a baseball player, and he actually got minor league contracts for two different teams and tried to get a hit. I don't think he ever did. I think he got one hit, but, you know, he was trying to, like, somehow see if he could do anything in baseball. It was sort of a stunt, but, you know, you talk about coming off the bench. Who is bigger than Garth Brooks that is out there that could return to recording and touring that's as big a name as him? Nobody. There's nobody that big that's been sitting around not recording and not releasing music for years. Michael Jackson's dead. Everybody else, you know, Prince, he's been touring. He's been releasing albums. So Garth Brooks is it. He really was huge. Now, mind you, it's been like 14 years since he had a hit album. And that last album was Scarecrow. It only sold 5 million copies in the U.S. Only. That was way down from his big, because he had that disastrous pop star thing where he tried to be Chris Gaines. He had an alter ego. It was a terrible idea. That album was a disaster. So he rebounded with his final album. And that still sold 5 million copies. And that's a long time ago. But I think people still really care for. You want to talk about someone that could actually sell a million copies first week? Garth Brooks is it.
Waiting to make money in syndication. It's so 2004. CBS is cashing in right away with reruns of summer series like Under the Dome and the upcoming event Zoo, based on a James Patterson novel about wild animals on the attack. Is there nothing that isn't based on a James Patterson novel these days?
I think so.
Dome was sold to Amazon, which paid nearly $1 million to air reruns of Dome. And the new Halle Berry series, Extant, or however you pronounce that.
Extant, I think.
They're also, I guess, airing those right after they air. Now Netflix is getting in on the act. They're reportedly paying even more to snag the rights for streaming the streaming of Zoo in 2015, and they have to wait until the entire series is aired before making episodes available. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. They've been doing this for a while because they're not part of Hulu. So reruns are something they can offer up. Good Wife goes to Hallmark, Amazon Prime, and Hulu for various windows and prices. They're just making money, and there's new people to play, and therefore Netflix is in the game, and therefore CBS can make money off of them. It's what you got to do. Shows are expensive.
I love this next story. The lawsuit between Marvel and the estate of Jack Kirby moves forward. Marvel recently filed papers with the Supreme Court explaining why they really, really shouldn't take the case. Meanwhile, in another alleged work of for hire lawsuit, a film version based on the board game Candyland is embroiled in lawsuits. Candyland. Let me repeat that. Candyland. A movie of Candyland. Anyway, Hasbro owns the rights to the game, which was created in the mid-1940s. But until 1984, the game was generic and had no characters beyond a boy and a girl. In that year, the company Landmark completely revamped the game, adding artwork, storylines, and characters like King Candy, Lord Licorice, and Princess Lolly of the Lollipop Woods.
I love her.
Yes. They did the work for Milton Bradley, which owned the game at that point and would be purchased by Hasbro. Landmark says they were paid $50,000 and future royalties. They discovered other uses beyond the agreed ones for which the company hasn't received royalties. Hasbro says it was a work for hire and they should just go away. Look, you fixed the toilet. You fixed the plumbing. I don't want to have to pay you every time I flush the toilet, to borrow the words of Lou Wasserman. Landmark says they own the rights to those characters and ideas for use in video games, movies, TV, and basically everywhere. Lawsuits are flying, and Adam Sandler, who was linked to the film project at one point, may just sigh with relief. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I'm going to say it's a big deal. Why do you love it so much? Just because it's about Candyland?
Because Candyland is, as far as game theory goes...
It's the most banal, simplistic game with no strategy or gaming in it whatsoever.
There is no game theory in this at all, other than it is complete random luck.
Right. You turn over the cards, you move, and it's over. There's no thinking to be done.
Right.
Probably the same thing of making a movie out of Candyland. But was it a work for hire? I mean, they say they have a specific contract saying, look, we created all this stuff, creative stuff. You get to use it for the game. But if you're going to use it any other way, either they didn't spell out the contract properly enough, or maybe they don't have the right to restrict them to just the game. You know, maybe Milton Bradley doesn't have the right to say, you know, we pay you to create all these characters and these inventive stuff, but you can't have any rights for them beyond what we use them for. I don't know.
I don't know either. And I actually, in reality, do think you could probably make a pretty good movie out of Candyland.
Really?
Better than the game.
Okay.
Which isn't saying much. Well, we can finally clear our files on one story. Sometimes we set aside a story waiting for the next development before, you know, tackling it here on Showbiz Sandbox. That's why for years, and I mean for years, we've had info on a lawsuit between Dick Clark Productions and the Hollywood Foreign Press Association over the Golden Globes. The Globes hired on Dick Clark Productions when they were nobody's. I mean, nobody knew who the, you know, HFPA was.
They were a joke.
Yeah, and the contract heavily favored the production company and gave them a big chunk of TV revenue. The Globes wanted to pull those rights back and were astonished when Dick Clark Productions signed a new deal with NBC to extend the Globes without even talking to the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Look at the contract, responded Dick Clark Productions. Look at our lawsuit, said the Globes. a lower court ruling was in favor of Dick Clark Productions, and it's been appealed. This has gone on literally for years. But, you know, in the meantime, Dick Clark passed away. His company was bought by new owners, and everyone decided, you know, it was time probably to make nice and play well together. The show is sticking with Dick Clark Productions and NBC, though the terms have of the settlement, they haven't been released. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's a contract dispute between two parties. However, I think it points the way to peace in Hollywood. If you've got a legal dispute, the way to solve it is clear. You simply die. Your Saul Zantz, your Dick Clark. If you've got a problem, James Garner, just die and everything will be okay.
Yeah, that's true. Like all these lawsuits get, because, you know, all the emotions are taken out of it. All of the ego is taken out of it when that happens.
I guess so.
Well, now I know that we mentioned this whole thing about Archie at the beginning, and we're talking about Archie Comics. And we don't have a write up here, but did you want to talk about Archie being dead and that Thor is now a woman?
Not really.
Okay, well, then maybe we should move on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now,
I'm gonna do this because you're going to talk, because this is complicated and I don't understand it at all.
Okay.
All right, so we've been off the air for a few weeks, and apparently while we were gone, everyone merged with everyone, or at least tried to.
So you know, and I don't mean to interrupt you, Michael, I'm always trying to merge.
Rupert Murdoch's Empire, 21st Century Fox, tried to take over Time Warner. Those are big companies. That's such a head-spinningly large potential merger. It almost seemed like a headline on The Onion instead of a real possibility, but it's still happening. Now Time Warner is seen as in play. They've taken poison pill precautions to try and make it harder for Murdoch to take them over. And the fact that CNN would have been spun off if this merger happens, that means now CNN is sort of in play. Meanwhile, John Malone's Liberty Global bought an $800 million stake in ITV, which is a UK pay channel?
I guess network? So, yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And BSkyB, here's where it gets really confusing. This is a Murdoch entity. 21st Century Fox owns about 40% of BSkyB. This is a British pay satellite TV company. They are merging, for sure, with Sky Italia and Sky Deutschland. And they're going to create what some are calling Sky Europe, a massive pan-national satellite TV service for all of Europe that's going to have 20 million homes and a potential reach of about 100 million people. At least they didn't call it Skynet.
Ooh, that's true.
Right. So, I mean, all I can think of is what's next, Google and Apple to merge? So I thought, you know, 21st Century Fox tried to merge with Time Warner. They made a bid. Time Warner said no. They took precautions to try and make it harder. And I thought, this is such a ridiculous thing. Maybe they're in play, but surely Fox and Time Warner are not going to merge. But Sperling, you say this is probably going to happen.
Well, I think that Time Warner could probably fend off News Corp. But now, because of this, basically, what wound up happening is News Corp came out, or 21st Century Fox came out and said, oh, by the way, people, we're going to publicly tell you that we have made an $80 billion offer for Time Warner, which is an absurd amount of money. Okay.
Is it?
Well, for that particular asset, yes. For that,
it is?
Yeah, it's definitely one of those, like, how do you really go much higher than that? Because it's such a you're paying such a premium for the stock.
Okay.
And so what that does is it does a couple of things. One, it tells everybody else out there, like a Google or an Apple or whoever has $80, $90, $100 billion to spend on Time Warner, it tells them, hey, if you're going to get into this game, you're going to have a lot of money. So a lot of people immediately drop out. It also, and more importantly, tells the shareholders of Time Warner, hey, you know, your shares are worth hypothetically $50 today, but we just offered to pay $60 or $70 for every share you own. So you could have made a lot of money. You could have made a huge premium.
So was there a shareholder outcry over them turning down this offer? Were people angry?
I don't think so. I think basically right now people are like, oh, this may not be
what?
Such. Yeah, this. Do we really want to go to News Corp? Aren't they the devil incarnate?
Well, profit holders just want to make money.
Right. And it is a board of directors fiduciary responsibility to do that. And, you know, boards have been sued in the past. HP most recently is probably the big one to mention, where they lost. They had to settle and pay $57 million to shareholders for not doing what was in the shareholders' best interest.
And if they do that, who pays? The company, I assume, not the board members themselves.
I believe it's the company, yes.
Right. So maybe shareholders weren't upset because they figured a merger like this would never get approved by the FCC.
Yeah, but the FCC has very little to say about it.
It hasn't happened, but I'm saying if they tried to get approval for this merger, surely people would object.
Well, people would object, but the FCC really only has to object over, I think there's like one channel that they own, right? That 21st Century Fox owns, I guess.
No, they would think it's too big. If Time Warner and Fox merge, they would control 40% of all TV programming.
That's right. That's right. And
40%. That's a huge amount. Is that monopolistic enough for you?
No, I'd like 70. 70% would be more of a monopolistic.
So you think it's a gimme that the FCC would absolutely approve of this?
I'm not. No, as a matter of fact, I think they would say you have to figure out Fox News or CNN, keep one.
Well, that of course they're not going to be able to keep both 24-hour news channels. But you're saying they would approve the merger with a few little qualifiers?
Yes, but what they could do is make the qualifiers so kind of...
Would they approve it or not?
With
they
qualifiers.
Can't say well, if you're saying they would make it so onerous to do it that they wouldn't happen, that means they wouldn't approve it.
Right. Well, yeah, they would basically say, no, we didn't stand in your way. However, you know, you can't hold us accountable for that. You didn't want to do it after we said that you'd have to do A, B, and C, none of which were actually something that anybody in their right mind would want to do.
Right. So, but you still think Time Warner's in play and someone's going to buy them?
Well, yeah, because when somebody just put a value on Time Warner, and all of the shareholders of Time Warner now know how much their stock is worth. And what they're saying is, hey, I don't know, what is their stock worth right now?
I don't know. But is it worth it if they feel that they were being overpaid and that the combined companies would not provide scale or profitability in the future? Yeah, it would depress their stock down the road because they think it's a bad merger of two big companies that don't deserve to be together, like, say, the Time Warner AOL deal.
Yeah, that didn't
stop
people.
Which was a bad deal. Right, that was a bad deal for the AOL people ultimately. I don't know, maybe people made money. But it's historically seen as not a great merger. Maybe they would say, nah, sure, they offered us a premium, but it would be a disastrous merger. Our stock prices would be depressed overall. We think we could make more money being independent.
Yeah, and I think they want their freedom. And there's no way you're going to...
Well, freedom. They're a multinational corporation. Who's talking about freedom?
Well, yeah.
They want to make money. Would they make more money combining with Fox?
It depends on how you look at it. It depends on, because really why this is happening is...
There's one big reason, right?
Yes, there's all these other mergers. So Time Warner and Fox, they are manufacturers. They create a product. That product is content.
You and your product.
Yes, well, you know, that's... They have a product that they have to sell. They sell it through sales channels. In this case, they're, you know, the sales channels are movie theaters and also premium cable and cable networks. And the problem that they're having now is that their sales channels are beginning to merge with one another. AT&T is buying DirecTV, or is it Dish? I can't remember. One of them. And then you have Time Warner Cable trying to buy Comcast. So the number of distribution methods of distribution or distribution outlets on television are beginning to combine, which when you go and seek retransmission fees or licensing fees, puts you in a weak spot.
They have to make deals with cable providers and with internet providers. And they're thinking we're too small.
Right, correct.
Fox is saying we're tiny. We're going to get pushed around by all these mergers.
And Warner Brothers is one of the biggest studios out there. So really, when you look at it, if you say, hey, yeah, you can play hardball with us, AT&T and DirecTV and Comcast and Time Warner, you could really play hardball with us. But do you really want to play hardball with 40% of the supply chain?
That's if they merged.
That's if they merged, yes.
Are you saying that Warner Brothers is Time Warner's too small now to stand its ground?
No,
and,
I think
and shouldn't
that's
some
the
of
thing.
These mergers not happen? These mergers aren't all a given.
I think that when it comes to, I think you really can be too big where your influence, and you're seeing it with Amazon, right? I think you can become way too big, and it's bad for creatives because how do you negotiate when 40% of the buyers out there it's one buyer.
Right. Is it too big in the sense that they won't make as much money as they would separately? Or is it too big? You think it's just bad for the world?
I think it's just bad for the world. And I am not an antitrust, you know, conspiracy theorist or, you know, I'm not against.
What?
I'm not against mergers and acquisitions. I just think that you can get to a point where you just get too big. It's not good for the industry at large.
Uh-huh.
And the community, frankly.
And so it's not that you would you want the other mergers to not happen either.
Well, you know, I do think Comcast, Time Warner Cable, look, let that merger happen if you then introduce competition in the marketplace. Exactly.
That's not happening.
Exactly. So if you're not going to introduce competition, then please don't create a bigger monopoly than you already have.
So that's all right. That's it. That's as big a merger. And frankly, if you're in Europe, perhaps the Sky Europe is the big news there.
Well, and the reason
that
Sky Europe
may not happen, that's a merger that is going to happen.
Yeah. And you mentioned the poison pill. Basically, what Time Warner did is they in their bylaws, they changed their bylaws so that shareholders couldn't call a special meeting to discuss things like, I don't know, the fact that they were just offered a premium on their stock by 21st Century Fox.
Well, that doesn't sound like much of a poison pill.
It's not much of a poison pill. It's just a way for the board to control the
what happens when.
Yeah, exactly. And as far as the news about Sky Europe, the reason that's noteworthy in this discussion of Time Warner is simply because what 21st Century Fox is doing is building up their cash war chest by selling off and frankly just transferring money between accounts, you know, assets from one division of News Corp to another.
Well, but that's a separate deal. I mean, this is a genuine merger of three big satellite TV providers.
Right. And that gives them like, you know, $8 or $9 billion to then add to their kitty to go after Time Warner.
Huh. All right. Well, so you don't think the Time Warner Fox merger is dead?
I don't think it's dead, which is why there's been so much ink spilled over it.
But some other people are dead.
Oh, man. I didn't see where you were going there. Okay. Yes. You know, ironically, on the plane to Boston, I was reading the little magazine they hand out.
That
I don't know why I read those things. I just do. But there was a whole thing on Elaine Stritch, and I thought, oh yeah, wow, she's really great. And then I get to Boston, and 2 days later, she passes away.
Why did they have a story about the movie about her, the documentary film, or what was the hook?
I think that was it. Yeah.
All right. So Elaine Stritch is one of the many people that died while we were away. She's a 4-time Tony nominee. I saw her on Broadway in her one-woman show, The Legendary Elaine Stritch at Liberty. Great show. She won the Emmy 3 times. She was on 30 Rock playing Alec Baldwin's mother. She's a Broadway legend. She's a broad. You talk about Elaine Stritch, you got to say broad. And if you want to celebrate her life, a great way is to watch the TV special, Elaine Stritch at Liberty. They filmed that Broadway one-woman show. It's not quite the same as seeing her in person, but it captures a little bit of her. Nadine Gordimer also died. She was a Nobel Prize winning writer, and I've never read a single word of what she's written.
Wow. Okay.
Have you? Yeah.
No, that speaks volumes.
Yes. Nice. So she's known as much for her political activism as her writing. I think that's fair to say, because she was writing in apartheid South Africa and captured that world. She never saw herself as a political writer, but I think her Nobel Prize, while she's also certainly critically acclaimed, is often linked to social issues and political issues. And that was one of the key reasons why she shot to worldwide fame, because she was writing about a world that people were slowly starting to focus on and denounce. And I think if you were going to start with her, it looks like I said, where do I start? Berger's Daughter seems like one of the 3 or 4 of her best books. But she was 90 years old, long distinguished career as a novelist. James Shigeta died.
I was waiting for you to get to this particular person. I was like, how is he going to pronounce that last name?
Well, I may be mispronouncing it, but I'm saying James Shigeta. He's a pioneering Hawaiian actor. He was on stage, screen, television, did a lot of great work. He was in Die Hard. I think that's what people of my generation remember. He was the businessman that was trapped in the building with the terrorists. And so that's where you might glimpse him. But he was certainly on television in the early days, on Broadway, the Flower Drum Song, the Rodgers and Hammerstein show. So, you know, he had a very distinguished career. Oscar-winning editor Tom Rolfe died. He was 83 years old. He was on the team that won the Oscar for The Right Stuff. And I've held one of those Oscars.
Because, oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so that's very cool, because I'm friends with the daughter of one of the Oscar-winning editors on The Right Stuff. And he also, Tom Rolfe, did War Games, Taxi Driver, Heaven's Gate. So he's got a great career, and he lived long enough to see Heaven's Gate get reclaimed from a complete disaster that brought down a studio to a movie that is more respected thanks to the better director's cut, though in this case you might even call it the film editor's cut, since they went back to the vision that Tom Rolfe and the director Michael Cimino had for that film.
Well, now, Taxi Driver, that wasn't Thelma Schoonmaker? Because Taxi Driver is a Scorsese film. Scorsese always works with Thelma Schoonmaker, so I wonder if maybe he didn't on that particular film.
Oh, by the way, since I'll deride you on this, no, you did read it wrong, because Rolling Stone, the story that you linked to about streaming services, did very clearly in both the headline, subhead, and in the story make clear that they were talking about times it was streamed, not not total songs available. So we were wrong about that.
Did we just go back? Like, what just happened there?
Well, I was killing time while I looked it up. Taxi Driver was edited by Tom Rolfe and Melvin Shapiro.
Okay, so you were basically vamping while the other 3% of your break, because we only use 6% on this show.
that's right. Okay. That's right. So he did do that. And James Garner, of course, a very fun actor. Always thought he should have been a bigger movie star. He died. And I was a little surprised by his obituaries.
Really? Why is that?
Well, we know he's remembered, of course, for two great TV shows, Maverick and The Rockford Files. He also did those great Polaroid commercials. Were you old enough then to see those?
Oh, yes.
The land camera with him and Marriott Hartley. They had such tremendous chemistry that people thought they were really married in real life. They literally were like, oh, I love your wife.
I'm old enough to remember Joe DiMaggio in the Folgers commercials. Now, of course,
Mr. Coffee,
of course. Mr. Coffee. Yeah, I'm sure I got that wrong and it's some other coffee, but still, you know.
He did the Mr. Coffee machines.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's what it was.
Yes. And so he also had some great movies. The Great Escape, Murphy's Romance, for which he got an Oscar nomination, and Victor Victoria. Certainly dive into Maverick or The Rockford Files or watch The Great Escape or Victor Victoria if you want to celebrate James Garner's life. But I thought there'd be more attention paid to what he did behind the scenes in Hollywood. When I think of James Garner, and I was lucky enough to interview him, I think about the trailblazing he worked fighting for the rights of actors. He fought his studio on Maverick, fought against his contract. He fought the studio on The Rockford Files because they were hiding profits. You know, said, hey, you owe me all this money for syndication and you're telling me like the show's been losing money. He fought them for years, tooth and nail, and won in the courts.
Yes, but I guess maybe people look at that and go, well, you won for yourself. However, studios and networks are still doing what they did to you.
Yeah, but he inspired other people to fight them and people sue all the time now. People demand better accounting. I think probably a lot of studios didn't rip off people as much because they knew, hey, people are now starting to pay attention. And he led the way for a lot of the people back in Maverick and then the Rockford Files in the 70s. And he showed again and again, look, when you make them open the books, you're going to find out you deserve more money than you're getting. And I've always thought that is a really signal important part of his career, a real contribution he made to Hollywood. But, I'm not surprised the mainstream press didn't talk about it. But I thought the trades would focus more on that or that accomplishment that James Garner did.
I was surprised. Well, I guess there was a lot of attention paid to the passing of Charlie Hayden, who was a jazz bassist. He played with Ornette Coleman in the 1950s and with Keith Jarrett in the 1970s. And he played all the way up to, I guess he had a couple shows just last year.
Oh, absolutely. He was still touring right to the end. He had his own group, Quartet West, and they're probably the most germane for fans of this show. He formed it in 1987, and they specialized in a sort of noirish cinematic type of music. They had lush orchestrations. They had covers of old standards from the 20s and 30s, and they also mixed in instrumental originals. Sometimes they would use snippets of dialogue, or they'd even use old film score music. They would have old songs performed by old artists mixed into their albums. Other times they'd get artists to cover these songs, you know, new female artists. So they were really kind of a really cool group that if you love movies, especially noir, and you love jazz, Charlie Hayden is in your sweet spot. And you should listen to like their debut album, Quartet West or Haunted Heart. Or if you're into Ornette Coleman, The Shape of Jazz to Come. They just released a few weeks ago Last Dance, which is one of his duets albums with Keith Jarrett. So he was recording right up to the end of his life. A really terrific artist that's been making great music for like 60 years. I've got a lot of his albums in my repertoire. And that's a nice thing. When somebody great like that dies, it's an excuse for somebody who hasn't paid attention to him before to dive into his body of work.
Kind of like Nadine Gordimer. Although, do you think it's ironic that they called his last album Last Dance?
Well, it was recorded like 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
When he and Keith Jarrett were in the studio. So it's just happenstance. It's certainly ironic.
Well, if you want to, you know, write to us and give us some feedback or even provide a few funny jokes as opposed to the ones that, you know, I try to pull off on this show, feel free to do so. You can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to contact us, but more importantly, or maybe more importantly, are ways to subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. However you get your podcasts, wherever podcasts are aggregated, you can usually find us. And if you can't, let us know and we'll try and get ourselves listed on whatever podcast aggregator you use. And please do rate and review the shows on those sites. It does help us out. And subscribe to the show. That also helps us out. You can follow us on Twitter where our handle is ShowbizSandbox. So twitter.com/ShowbizSandbox. On Facebook, we can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Really hard. All of that information, again, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's a different website. Michael, what is the name of your website this week?
It's groundhogday.com.
Wait, that actually might be a website. So
that might actually be a website.
So if you if you spend a lot of time there and still can't find any of Michael's writing on theater or entertainment or movies or music or books, if you can't find it there, try.
It certainly is. It is not a website. It's like it's one of those websites where they just hold it and like put links for auto insurance quote, home equity mortgage. You know, so somebody bought it, but they're not doing anything useful with it.
Well, then head on over to michaelgiltz.com or the Huffington Post. You can find some of Michael's writing on entertainment there. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.